Outside Looking In, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Millions across the globe tuned in to watch the Trump-Clinton debate last night. In Nigeria, some stayed up late for the drama, not the content.
When we compared the conversations we're hearing in America to the things that are happening here, it appears so light, so almost inconsequential.
Plus, we meet the man who interpreted Trump last night for Spanish language television.
You have to discard any politics and just do your job.
And a Colombian American on why he supports the government's peace accord with FARC rebels.
It's a chance for Colombians to build a new country. It's important to move on from that discourse of hate and divisiveness.
Those stories coming up today here on The World. Thank you for being with us today. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are out campaigning again after last night's debate. Trump traveled to Florida, Clinton to North Carolina. On the show today, we're going even further afield to get some outside perspectives on all of this, to a debate viewing party in Mexico and a stopover in London where televised debates are a very new thing. First, though, to Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Journalist and author Adobe Trisha Nobani is there. She says many of her friends and acquaintances stayed up late to watch the Clinton-Trump debate.
Everybody, right down to the gate man at my office. People
really?
Were talking about it. Yes. And then I spoke with a Nigerian friend in the UK this morning. She also had stayed up to watch it in London. I mean, I don't know many people who did not watch it.
That's incredible. So what were people saying today? I mean, what parts of the debate really hit home?
The most frequent comment I heard was that, Clinton won, Clinton won, Clinton won. People said things like she seemed to know more about the issues. Trump didn't seem to know too much about what he was talking about. You know, we've come to know Trump as an entertainer. He always leaves us with something to talk about. There's all this drama, which seemed to be missing from him last night. Like, that wasn't the Trump we've come to expect, you know, throwing punches and embarrassing everybody.
Yeah, did Nigerians watch The Apprentice with Donald Trump? I mean, is that where this...
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Reality TV shows. American reality TV shows are quite common here. So everybody knows he's a reality TV star. And I think that's what we've come to expect. A secretary at my office actually made the comment that it's not like when he's on the campaign trail and talking anyhow, and here he was standing with Clinton and he wasn't able to do any of that nonsense he does. For example, everybody expected that he would have referred to Bill Clinton's indiscretions, but he didn't.
Well, both candidates did address racism and America's complex legacy when it comes to race. Let's hear what Donald Trump had to say. Here he is talking about fighting gun crime in inner cities.
We have to bring back law and order. We have gangs roaming the street, and in many cases, they're illegally here, illegal immigrants, and they have guns. And they shoot people. And we have to be very strong. And we have to be very vigilant.
All right. Talk of law and order from Donald Trump. Adobe Trisha Nobani, how does that go over in a country like Nigeria that's elected any number of military generals to lead the country?
We have major law and order problems here as well. And it's interesting to watch because the worst Trump prescription will still be lighter than the lightest Nigerian prescription in terms of that kind of thing, the way the police and the military deal with civilians, that kind of thing. Anyhow America deals with it will still be less brutal, like I would imagine, than our own problems.
Right.
Just a few weeks ago, there was a report from Amnesty International about the way our police here deal with suspected criminals. There were all sorts of atrocities described in that report. Things like hanging prisoners by their necks and fake executions and things like that.
That you would find in Nigeria.
So that's what I'm saying, that you would find in Nigerian techniques that our police use. We're horrified by the fact that so many black people have been shot. But at the same time, we can't pretend that we're shocked that people are stopped and searched. I don't want black people or white people or whoever to be shot and killed in interactions with the police. But I can't pretend that I'm horrified by the fact that the police stopped and searched someone. And I don't think the average Nigerian will be horrified by that. We go through worse with our police here.
So you probably know that Donald Trump has refused to release his tax returns, and that's something that all previous major candidates for the presidency here have done. Hillary Clinton is criticized for not releasing emails and transcripts of paid speeches she made to leaders of big U.S. banks. Is that sort of transparency expected of politicians in Nigeria?
I'll just laugh. I will just laugh. Maybe you're just trying to mock us. But anyway, no, it's even difficult to get our politicians to declare their assets. We don't even know what they own and what they don't own. So tax returns is going far. in terms of expectations. That's part of the entertainment I talk about when we watch things like the US debate. These people consider these things big issues. So it's educative, but it's also very entertaining to see the things that are important to the Americans, the things that they consider debate worthy, the things that steal the headlines that will just not grab a sentence or of a column in this part of the world. When we compare the conversations we're hearing in America to the things that are happening here, it appears so light, so almost inconsequential. It's interesting to see a place where these conversations are happening that are so distant from where we are.
Nigerian journalist and author Adobe Trisha Nobani, speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. Her most recent novel is I Do Not Come to You by Chance. Adobe, thanks for being with us, as always.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you for having me.
Immigration has been a big theme through the presidential campaign and has led to some nasty rhetoric, but it didn't come up in any meaningful way last night. Still, many Mexicans tuned in. Reporter James Frederick is based in Mexico City and went to a viewing party last night. Set the scene for us, James. What was the main interest for Mexicans in the debate?
Well, so fittingly, this debate party happened at a Texas barbecue place here in Mexico City run by an American expat. So that made sense. But yeah, it was a mix of Mexican-American dual nationals, as well as Mexicans who were just interested, or I guess better said, worried about the U.S. presidential race. And it was fun to watch it. I think, you know, as you mentioned, it was a bit of a bummer for the audience that immigration didn't get brought up, because that was, you know, really what they were waiting for. The main thing that happened was every time Trump said Mexico, there was a big cheer from the audience. So, you know, as much as Mexicans are angry with Trump and the generalizations he's made about Mexicans and the claim that, you know, they're stealing American jobs and stuff, more than anything, people were having fun with it. It was a bit of a bummer that immigration didn't get brought up. But yeah, there were a lot of interested people last night. You know, if people didn't watch the debate last night, they certainly heard about it this morning. It was on the front page of every newspaper I saw here in Mexico City.
Yeah, what kind of headlines were you seeing?
The best headline I saw was on one of Mexico's tabloidy newspapers called La Prensa, and it said "Nos odia," he hates us in Spanish, and so that was the loudest headline I saw here. But basically, what all of the newspapers in Mexico agreed was that Hillary maintained her poise and Trump kind of looked silly, which is, I think, what everybody in Mexico was hoping for. You know, they wanted Trump to be taken down a peg. I'm looking at a newspaper right here, El Universal, and they have a poll from about a dozen different Mexican analysts who rated the debate. And so, at least according to this poll, Hillary Clinton won the debate with a rating of 8.5. Donald Trump only got a rating of 6.4 in this newspaper.
I see also that some newspapers were focusing on the fact that the peso gained more than any other currency overnight.
This has really become a big story in Mexico over the last few weeks. If you watch the movement of the peso, it is pretty closely in line with Trump's polls. So when Trump starts doing better in the polls, the Mexican peso depreciates, you know, it loses value. What happened overnight was that the peso gained more value than any other currency in the world. So that was the other thing the paper said, is that, you know, the investors spoke and they think Trump lost the debate because the peso did better.
Now, apparently on social media, the phrase "register to vote" was really popular last night. Is the debate driving a push for Latino voter registration?
So in Mexico alone, there's more than 1 million U.S. citizens. So that's a mix of expats and dual nationals. But there are a lot of U.S. citizens who live in Mexico. And so there's a push by several groups to get more U.S. citizens to vote from abroad. So there was the hashtag you mentioned, registrarse a votar. So there's also a push by non-citizens to say, well, you know, almost everybody in Mexico knows somebody who lives in the United States. And so the push is, if you know somebody who's a citizen, tell them to vote. There's an obvious reason that this is gaining so much steam, and it's Trump. The anti-Trump backlash does seem to be generating interest in getting more people, more U.S. citizens who are in Mexico to vote.
How did most Mexicans actually watch the debate last night? Was it simultaneous translation?
Yeah, that was how most watched it. It was on a few TV networks here, but I'm guessing a lot more Mexicans are reading about it in the papers this morning than watched it last night. And the consensus here in Mexico is that Trump lost, which they're happy about.
Reporter James Frederick in Mexico City, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Donald Trump piensa que esto es una mentira.
Yo no dije eso. El no digo eso.
Cambio climático.
That's how Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump sounded on Univision last night. Trump's Spanish language voice was the work of Vicente de la Vega. He's interpreted for many, many candidates and presidents over the years. He's also the CEO of Precision Translating Services. So, Vicente, how do you actually prepare to be Donald Trump?
In order to do broadcast simultaneous interpreting, you have to know intimately, I would say, the person you're going to be interpreting for. I listen to as many of the interviews I can possibly listen to, normally in YouTube, as well as the different rallies that candidate Trump attends.
Were you ready to sniff every 30 seconds as he did last night?
No.
So technically, tell us how this works, because the woman doing the interpretation of Hillary Clinton, we just heard that. Was she in the same room with you? Do you have to follow the visual cues and pay close attention to grimaces, for example?
Yes, we do. The setup last night was all three of us, the simultaneous interpreting for Mr. Holt, my colleague interpreting for Hillary Clinton, and I were seated in the same room watching the debate on a monitor. And the idea of being seated in the same room is so that we do not step over each other's voices. If the candidates do step over each other, then we do in our interpretation.
What about tone? Like if a candidate yells or suddenly gets quiet and whispers, you also have to follow suit, or do you kind of play it straight, just the words?
No, we have to follow suit. Mm. We have to mimic what they do in the foreign language.
What would you say are the biggest challenges for you of interpreting for a candidate simultaneously?
It all depends who the candidate is. Some candidates like Ross Perot spoke with a lot of regional expressions, and we have to be extremely familiar with those.
You've done Ross Perot. You've also interpreted Trump and Reagan, Clinton, both Bushes, and President Obama. Is there one candidate that has been difficult?
Two come to mind. Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton tended to speak and leave dangling clauses and then later come back to them. And also President Bush Jr. at times pronounced words in a quirky way, which made it difficult to understand and give you a nanosecond of tremors.
What was a word that George W. Bush had a funny way of pronouncing?
One of them that comes to mind was nuclear.
As opposed to nuclear?
Correct. I think out of all of the presidents, U.S. presidents, that I've interpreted for, the one I enjoyed interpreting for the most was Ronald Reagan.
Why?
He was very eloquent. He had a fabulous speech pattern, emphasis where it had to be put, lack of where he didn't have to do it. He was great. He was really, really my favorite.
How did you get into this business in the first place?
Well, as I was a child, I studied in a bilingual school in Cuba.
In Cuba?
Yeah, where they taught me in Cuba. I'm originally from Havana, Cuba. Came to the States in 1960 as a 12-year-old child. And in my school, they taught us Spanish and English. It was a bilingual school. I always had a love for languages. When I came here to the States, I went to a public library and checked out some books to learn French and German. That started what has been, to me, a career that I have loved for the past 46 years.
You've done a couple of Trump rallies where you did the simultaneous interpretation, one of them being that rally in Arizona last month where it was all about immigration. When you do simultaneous interpretation for an event like that, how hard is it to put politics aside?
As a seasoned broadcast simultaneous interpreter, it is not hard at all. You have to discard any politics and just do your job.
Vicente de la Vega, CEO of Precision Translating Services and the Spanish language interpreter for Donald Trump last night on Univision. Gracias. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to The World. For as long as most people in Colombia can remember, there's been war in the country. More than 50 years of violence between the government and leftist rebels. That is until yesterday, when the main rebel group known as the FARC formally signed a peace deal with the government. But there's one more hitch. Colombians have to approve the peace deal in a referendum this weekend before it can go into effect. And there is a powerful no campaign. Reporter Luis Gallo is in Bogota. He's an American born in Colombia. And like so many Colombians and Colombian Americans, he has a personal stake in the story. In Gallo's case, his own father was killed by the FARC.
He had been part of the Colombian National Police. and he was in charge of the Caribbean coast in the 80s. And then in the 90s, he left the armed forces and joined the Colombian National Oil Company, and they were building a pipeline through Colombia. So he was in charge of security and logistics, and there was an attack on this oil pipeline. And
by whom?
By the FARC.
Right.
And him and three other engineers were taken hostage. They knew my father. The FARC knew my father because of his previous operations in the region with the military, with the national police. So, yeah, they took him in and they did a war trial and they killed him. Yeah.
Wow. I'm so sorry to hear that story. How old were you when your father was killed?
I was 6 years old.
6 years old. And you were 14 when you moved to the U.S.?
I was 13 and a half, almost right. 14 when I moved to the U.S.
How did that episode in your life kind of affect your whole view of this peace deal?
I mean, I think, yeah, it was a really painful, part of my life. But at the same time, I think I was able to move on from that and, also learned from the experience. And I mean, now that I look back at what happened to us, yeah, we were a victim to this, this conflict. But I think thinking of, moving on and, a reconciliation and wanting to live in peace and having also given the chance to other Colombians to live in peace, I want to vote for the yes. I support the accord. I don't want any more lives to go like this. Other families to have to go through the same, pain. And I think, yeah, it's a chance for Colombians to build a new country for the future generations. I think I don't want to dwell on what happened in the past, although it's painful. And I definitely felt the pain and the repercussions from what happened. Mm-hmm. I do think it's important to move on from that discourse of hate and divisiveness and build a peaceful society where we could, disagree on different political, ideals, but still, get along and not kill each other.
Right. I mean, you're an American now. Can you actually vote in the referendum on Sunday?
Yeah, so I'm dual citizen.
I see.
So I am voting.
And what about the rest of your family? Do they all agree with you? Your mom, how does she feel about this vote?
So my family is pretty divided, and that's been kind of typical in most Colombian families with friends that I've talked to. Yeah, obviously, the previous generation, like my mother's, my aunts, my uncles, most of their lives, Colombia was at war. So they haven't known a peaceful Colombia. They haven't gotten a chance to imagine a different country.
Will your mother vote for the peace deal or vote against it?
I think she's voting against it.
And yeah. What reason does she give?
I mean, she says that, it's been really painful what we had to go through. She also thinks that the type of amnesty that the FARC rebels that confess the crimes are getting is really unfair. She also thinks that the FARC should not be given political seats in Congress. And yeah, so she believes that, a better deal could be reached where, the FARC will pay for their crimes. And I think that resonates with a lot of other Colombians, especially people who have had, families been affected by the conflict and they've been victims of the conflict.
She basically wants these FARC rebels, former rebels, to be punished. Is that right?
Right, or have a harsher punishment because under the deal, if they confess the truths, they're not going to be facing jail time or regular jail time. They're going to be deprived of their freedom, but in a special, justice tribunal and be given community service. So I think, understandably, I definitely understand where she comes from. I mean, not to say that my family or my mother, doesn't have a right to feel that way. I mean, her husband was killed, her life project was, totally changed suddenly. So yeah, so these are very, very real trauma that, many Colombians have lived. And I think there's also a collective trauma that, Colombian society has lived through. And, getting over these traumas and these ideas is very hard because it's been ingrained of, living in Colombia, just the reality of living here.
Right. I mean, you said the vote had kind of divided your family. Did it divide your family in a negative way?
I wouldn't say in a negative way. I think it started a new dialogue. So most of the younger generation, like my cousins, We all want to vote for yes. You know, we want the peace to come to Colombia finally. But and then we talk in family reunions. We talk at, you know, the dinner table, and we try to persuade each other. So we still have some aunts and uncles that are not fully decided on what they're going to vote. And, you know, as long as we, you know, we're respectful, we understand where each other's coming from. Just because my aunt or my mother votes no, I'm not going to love her any less. And I think they see it the same way for us. But we do have a dialogue. And I think it's interesting what's happening, because, you know, all these dialogues are starting from a very small scale, like within the family. And then it's, you know, it's transferring to like a larger public sphere. Mm. And I think this is, you know, we're practicing democracy. We're practicing a way of sharing our ideas without going to guns and, you know, resorting to guns and violence to share our ideas and our values as well.
All right. Talk it out. Colombian American reporter Luis Gallo in Bogota. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Here's music from a place with a conflict that also goes back nearly 50 years. Western Sahara, that sparsely populated outpost in northwest Africa along the Atlantic. Aziza Brahim, the singer and songwriter here, is also an activist for the native Sahrawi people of Western Sahara. She grew up in the Algerian desert in a Sahrawi refugee camp. Then more than 20 years ago, she left, first for Cuba. Now she lives in Barcelona. You can hear the Spanish influence in her music, but it goes deeper than that. Western Sahara, formerly Spanish Sahara, was the product of a clash between Spain and Morocco over the territory. So Spain has been a part of Aziza Brahim's cultural world her whole life, and so has the conflict which has kept her from home. The title of this track says it all, Buscando la Paz, Looking for Peace. Stick around, you're with the world.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Here's a smart move, drivers. Reach across your body and open your car door with your right hand. It forces you to look back and watch out for cyclists. The Dutch think it just makes sense.
In fact, they considered it such common sense that no one needed a name for it.
This American calls it the Dutch Reach. More on that ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We're still thinking about last night's debate. Probably so are Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. The candidates know as well as anybody that televised debates can have a big effect on the outcome of an election. We've seen this since the first one in history between JFK and Nixon, exactly 56 years before Trump and Clinton faced off last night. Televised debates are a much newer thing in Britain. The first one between party leaders there only happened in 2010. My colleague at the BBC, Paul Moss, has covered both U.S. and U.K. general elections. I mentioned Kennedy versus Nixon, Paul, but that happened in 1960. I'd have thought the U.K. would have seen that and tried to organize their own political debate on the BBC right away. That didn't happen?
It didn't happen, but it very nearly did. Obviously, with the Nixon versus Kennedy debate in mind, in 1964 we had an election, and the Labour challenger, Harold Wilson, the leader of the Labour Party, he said to Alex Douglas-Home, the Conservative Prime Minister, that he wanted a debate. But Alex Douglas Holmes said it would be like a pop music concert. I guess he was looking at the way in which Nixon had been judged, perhaps in which a lot of people talked about Nixon's appearance rather than what he had to say.
Right, kind of sweaty and pale-faced.
Exactly. But there was also a certain, I suppose, disdain in that phrase. It would be like a pop music concert, you know, disdain for turning politics into that. But here's what's very funny is that a few years later, Harold Wilson had become the prime minister. The conservative challenger was Edward Heath. And he said he wanted then to have a debate. And Harold Wilson said no. Apparently, what he said is that if he'd had a debate, he would give Edward Heath the chance to look like a prime minister. And that's what he didn't want. So there you have an early pattern where the incumbent doesn't want it because, after all, why give any more room for the other guy to look any good?
Right. So why did it take another nearly 50 years to have the first debate
just,
in the UK?
It just goes on. Yeah. In 1979, we have the first time where it was the incumbent, a Labour Prime Minister, James Callaghan, who said he wanted a debate. And a woman called Margaret Thatcher was the challenger then. And she said, no, that having debates was not the British thing. And it wasn't, as you say, until 2010 that we got together and had that leaders' debate.
Yeah, refresh my memory, 2010, who won that election?
Well, that was when David Cameron won and Gordon Brown wasn't seen as being so nimble on his feet. And then again in 2015, the same happened. I should say that's the only one I know where we had actual research done, where they asked people, did the TV debates make a difference? And in that case, 38% of them said, yes, this made a difference. That is a huge number.
I mean, there is a perception here that the TV debates have helped to focus the contest on body language and personality and that they've kind of become a disservice to understanding the issues. I guess that entertainment factor that dissuaded those British politicians in the 60s. Has Britain so far been able to avoid that?
Well, that is a big debate within British politics. A lot of people have suggested that British politics has become more personality-based, more showbiz-like. You had certain moments, for example, in the last general election debate where there were some really heavy put-downs that everyone remembered, single one-liners. We had Nigel Farage from the group UKIP, which tends to stand on an anti-immigrant platform. And Nigel Farage complained that too many immigrants were coming to Britain with HIV. Another candidate turned around and said, Nigel Farage, you should be ashamed of yourself. He then blustered and at one point blamed the audience for being biased. This sort of thing does focus attention on the personalities, probably inevitably focus a little more on that than on the policies.
British politicians are so good at Westminster at going into debates with each other. It doesn't really translate, though, to just one-on-one on stage, I guess.
It doesn't. But then I should say that, you know, there is a fine tradition of this in Britain that predates politics. I mean, when I was at high school, we had to do debating. I was at one point even, can I dare say it, on the debating team. Now, to be honest, that was because no one was ever going to pick me for the soccer team or the rugby team or the cricket team because I was rubbish at sport. But I did get to be on the debating team. And, you know, they do take this very seriously. You're taught the skills of rhetoric. You kind of look ridiculous because you're 12 years old wearing a shirt and tie and jacket and, you know, standing there and pontificating like you're at the dispatch box in Parliament and using all sorts of turns of phrases like, well, allow me to address the honourable lady over there. But seriously, this is a skill that we learned at school. And also it's particularly a skill that they teach at the very privileged schools like Eton, where David Cameron went, and Boris Johnson. They've been doing this for decades. They've literally been doing it since they were at high school. And that means that what you see, not for all of them, but some of them when they go into Parliament and, you know, this is something that they're an old hand at. It's perhaps why they went into politics in the first place. They kind of like that whole cut and thrust of the debate.
My BBC colleague Paul Moss, thanks for filling us in.
Thank you, Marco. A pleasure.
It's the economy, stupid, an expression from the 1990s. It still has currency today. At last night's debate, the very first question put to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump was about jobs. Clinton talked about building an economy that benefits everyone, not just those at the top. And Trump repeated something that's helped propel his campaign from the very start. He said American jobs are being stolen by other countries.
You look at what China is doing to our country in terms of making our product. They're devaluing their currency, and there's nobody in our government to fight them. And we have a very good fight, and we have a winning fight, because they're using our country as a piggy bank to rebuild China. And many other countries are doing the same thing. So we're losing our good jobs, so many of them.
If you live here in the U.S. and you used to have one of those good jobs, that might sound spot on. But if you're in China, Trump's words probably leave you scratching your head.
This is a country that in the previous decade lost more manufacturing jobs than all the rest of the world put together. So they know the pain that people feel in places like Ohio and North Carolina.
Patrick Wynn there is the world's Asia correspondent. He says Trump's rhetoric on jobs is outdated.
I'm really thinking about the low-end factory jobs, really low-skill factory jobs that you can take someone basically out of the rice fields and put them in a factory and they can do with some adeptness. Mainly thinking about
like the garment industry?
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yep. China still produces about 40% of America's clothes, but that has really fallen. Now China's too expensive. 10 years ago, you could pay a Chinese factory worker stitching tennis shoes about $1 per hour, and now they want double or triple that amount. And that's a good thing. That means the economy has evolved and people have higher standards. So that's kind of a good problem to have.
But are those companies paying that $3 an hour, or are they just sending the jobs elsewhere? And where is elsewhere?
No, of course. U.S. conglomerates, other conglomerates, they have no loyalty to factory workers in America or China. They go, it's a race to the bottom. So the bottom is in China's periphery. We're talking about countries like Bangladesh. You can get someone working a garment factory job for $17 a week. Or Cambodia, 50 cents an hour, really low prices. So yeah, they're leaving China because China is now too expensive. So Trump says that China has stolen our jobs. I think there's something very ridiculous about talking about stealing jobs. No country has a divine right to have garment factories. China, using that same logic, could definitely say that Bangladesh stole our jobs, Cambodia stole our jobs.
So Southeast Asia, are they the big winner here?
Yeah, I would say Cambodia, Bangladesh, and Vietnam. Definitely Vietnam. Vietnam's probably the biggest winner. Vietnam has gotten a lot of these low-skilled jobs. Vietnam's now producing about 10% of America's clothing. So I would wager that most people listening to this, if you look in your closet, you'll find some hoodies or T-shirts made in Vietnam.
Yeah, for sure. I know I have a pair of sneakers that are made in Vietnam. So, but then is Vietnam, is Southeast Asia going to be the next area that will have economies flattening out? And then where do the jobs go?
That's a great question. You know, economists talk about garment stitching jobs as the first rung on the ladder when you want to pull yourself out of being a very basic agricultural society. So Vietnam is a country I think is very well positioned to have higher end manufacturing jobs. In fact, you're already seeing that. And then at some point, yeah, they'll have the same issue. People, Vietnamese workers will say, I'm not doing this for a dollar an hour.
You know, another thing that comes to mind from last night's debate, Patrick, and I know this stood out for you too, is what Trump mentioned about infrastructure in the United States, and that compared to like airports in Dubai and Asia, we look, he said, like a third world country. I know you spend a lot of time in those airports. Does he have a point?
Trump has a point. I got to give it to him. The only thing I'll take issue with is he used the word third world, which is kind of an insulting Cold War era phrase, saying you come back to the United States and it's like our airports are third world. That term is meant to indicate the powerlessness of these countries during the Cold War era. It's very outdated. But now these quote-unquote third world countries have much nicer airports. These are the airports that are ranked by passengers as better than JFK. In Malaysia, Dubai, Bangkok, Bogota, Colombia, Jakarta, everyone seems to think their airports are better than JFK, and they're right.
The world's Patrick Wynn in Bangkok. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
Pull on your rubber boots. This is harvest week in the vineyards of Burgundy in France, and winemakers around the town of Chablis are bracing for some bad news. The area was devastated by floods, frost, and hail last spring, damaging the vineyards, so there are fewer grapes to pick, and production of Chablis in Chablis is expected to be down 70% overall. Reporter Adeline Sia spoke with some of the winemakers.
The hills in this part of Burgundy are postcard perfect. Around the villages of Chablis and Irancy, you see beautifully combed, lush green vineyards. I'm driving up a hill on the estate of winemaker Christophe Ferrari.
C'est vraiment l'endroit où on veut faire la qualité du raisin et la qualité d'un vin. C'est au travail de la vigne.
The vineyard is where you make the quality of your grapes and your wine, he says. If you can't produce nice grapes, you can't create good wine. There's a stunning 360-degree view at the top and plenty of healthy-looking leaves around. But when you look closely, you realize this greenery hides a dire reality.
Ici, on est donc en Croix, la Croix-Rouge, le lieu dit la Croix-Rouge.
Ferrari says here on his nine-acre vineyard, known as La Croix-Rouge, there isn't a single grape, something he hasn't seen in his 30 years of winemaking. He says a harsh winter-like frost killed all the promising buds over 3 nights in late April. The morning after the frost, he saw immediately there would be no harvest from this plot. There's not even a single bunch, I asked.
Il y en a peut-être une, mais on va la laisser au blaireau, il faut que tout le monde mange, quoi. C'est même pas la peine de venir la chercher.
Well, there might be one, he said, but we'll leave it to the badgers, so that everyone gets something to eat. It's not worth coming up here to get it. You can tell Ferrari is crushed to see all his painstaking work on the vineyard annihilated. He usually produces 20,000 bottles of Chablis a year, but he won't make a single one in 2016. And he's not alone. Most of the region's 750 winemakers were affected by a succession of floods, frost, and hail last spring. Frédéric Guéguin is the president of the Chablis Wine Growers Association. He estimates the harvest will be down to a third of its usual size. Guéguin lives in the village of Préhy. He takes me around his vineyard at the back of his house.
Là, aucune grappe. Vous voyez, on a fait 15 mètres dans la vigne.
Here, no grapes, you see? We walked about 15 yards into the vineyard, and I just saw one little bunch of grapes. Usually we have 15 bunches per vine. We may get two or three instead, but it may be worth harvesting. That could be about a fifth of what we normally do, but that's better than nothing.
This plot was almost completely destroyed by a brutal hailstorm last May, eerily following a previous one exactly 2 weeks earlier at exactly the same time of day. Guéguin was just coming home when it hit. He watched through the kitchen window as the hail trashed his vineyard.
Je rentre dans la maison et j'ai vu ma vigne.
I went inside the house, and in a few seconds, I saw my vineyard going from a green, leafy state with long twigs to nothing, zero, with a thick layer of hail on the ground. I told myself it would never end. It was hitting so hard. The ground was white as in winter. It was very violent. You could get hit in the face with this. You'd have tears in your eyes, and you'd feel lost.
The DNA of Chablis wine is in the terroir, that quality of the soil that contains limestone and fossils, and gives it its salty, briny taste and its popularity around the world. Guéguin sells about 30% of his wines in the United States, and his Boston-area importer, Hugh McPhail, says the Chardonnays of Chablis are very distinctive.
The sommeliers love Chablis because it doesn't taste like Chardonnay from any other part of the world. Some people compare it to wet rocks, slate after the rain, things like that. You can close your eyes and generally know that you're having Chablis as opposed to something else.
Back in Burgundy, wine growers see the fresh green leaves in the vineyards as a hopeful sign that next year could be close to normal. But between harvests that occur earlier every year and more frequent freak storms, it's clear to them there's nothing normal about the climate. So Guéguin says they've turned to a defense strategy known as cloud seeding and what would seem like crackpot weather contraptions.
Aujourd'hui dans le vignoble chablisien, on va mettre en place des systèmes de canons anti-grêle.
Today in the Chablis wine growing area, we're going to set up anti-hail cannons. What they do is spray silver iodide into the storm clouds to prevent hailstones from solidifying.
So if the timing is right, you get torrential rains instead. Wine importer McPhail is dubious about this technology, but says the economic stakes are so high, it's worth giving it a shot.
There are parts of Burgundy that have been hit by hail 4 years in a row now, huh? With the change in climate. I mean, this is some of the most expensive land in the world, you know, and if you can't grow crops on it, it's a major economic impact.
40 of those anti-hail cannons will be set up in the Chablis area next year, and hundreds of winemakers here hope they will ward off widespread destruction. For the world, Adeline Cyr, Burgundy, France.
Why the Dutch way of opening the car door with your other hand could save lives. That's still ahead here on The World. Frank Westerman is Dutch. 30 years ago, he was hitchhiking through Spain, and he had to spend the night in a small town north of Barcelona. It had a natural history museum.
I was told that the pride of this museum was a stuffed man. I was really, really shocked and ashamed to discover in a glass case a black man stuffed and mounted on display like a wild animal.
The stuffed man was known locally as El Negro, and Frank Westerman felt compelled to find out his story.
It had been there for most of the 20th century. What am I looking at? I felt confronted with my own whiteness, with my own past as a Dutchman, as a European. And I had the sensation that El Negro was actually telling a story about us, about the European past, the colonial past, race relations. This was considered normal in the 19th century, but we're speaking about 1983.
You dug in, though, on his story, and you found out a few things about right. How this all happened. What'd you learn?
I decided to write a book about him, and I had to go back to 19th century, actually 1831, and there happened to be a young French taxidermist who actually attended the funeral of a Tswana warrior. And he decided to come back at night and dig up the body and take the body. He violated the grave, and then he violated the body because he took away the skin and the bones and the skull. He prepared the body, and he shipped them to Paris.
So this man's body was on display, as you say, first in Paris, then to Spain, where you saw it in 1983. How much longer did he stay on display?
The first real controversy started around 1992 when the Olympic Summer Games came to Barcelona. Mm. And there was a Spanish physician of Haitian origin, and he wrote a letter to the newspaper El País saying, "Isn't it time that we remove El Negro?"
They were worried about visitors for the Olympics coming and seeing this, I suppose.
Absolutely. And that was his point. And to me, it was fascinating because many Catalan people, the part of Spain where El Negro was put on display, actually felt he was theirs. And during Carnival, people dressed up as El Negro and danced on the main square. Even the local chocolate factory they make chocolates in the profile of El Negro. Wow.
And this is the early 1990s.
Absolutely. It lasted till 2000, the year that Spain made a final arrangement with Botswana to repatriate the remains for reburial in Botswana.
When you've spoken with people in Botswana about this man, what do they know of him? Do they know the full story?
Yes and no. There was a ceremony, and he was laid to rest, and people paid their respects. There was dancing and singing and crying. And then his grave was, for a few years, completely neglected. It was used as a football pitch when I was there. But lately, the Botswana government has enhanced the site, and I think there is a visitor center right now. But as a metaphor, as the embodiment of colonial European thought about black people. The story hasn't ended.
It is a surreal story and, frankly, still very shocking. Frank Westerman, thanks for telling us about it.
Thank you.
Frank Westerman is the author of El Negro and Me. Finally today, another story with a Dutch connection. It involves something that's personal for me, and that's getting doored. I ride my bike to work, and all too often I have to swerve suddenly to avoid someone opening their car door. It's dangerous. Michael Charney is trying to make it safer. He wants us to open our car doors with a move he calls the Dutch Reach.
The Dutch Reach is a practice where instead of using your near hand, meaning usually the driver's left hand, to open your car door, you use your far hand, your right hand. That makes you have to reach across your body to do that
right. And
grab the door handle. And in doing that, you automatically swivel your body and you position your head and shoulders so you're looking directly out. You're looking out, you first pass the rearview mirror, which you glance at, and then you're seeing straight out. And then you're very easily able to look back and see if there's oncoming bicycles or trucks or cars or whatever.
Right, and preventing that all-too-common accident here in the Boston area, getting doored if you're on your bike by
a car. Or also called a near-door experience.
Right.
When you manage to swerve and avoid. But the danger there is you can end up in traffic.
Right. You end up by getting hit by a car trying to avoid the door.
And that is what kicked this project off.
Was it a personal thing for you?
Well, within blocks of where I live, a woman named Amanda Phillips, a 27-year-old from Somerville, Massachusetts, a barista and a nursing student, was taking a turn and came up against the door that was open in front of her. She was knocked off her bike and into oncoming traffic and run over by a landscaping truck and died. That happened on the 23rd of June, and the next day I was reading the comments section in our paper, the Boston Globe, and somebody posted a link. He asked the question, he says, what's going on here, basically? You know, don't you know the Dutch have a better way? So, curious, I looked, and indeed, it described the Dutch Reach, what I now call the Dutch Reach.
Right.
And took it from there.
Was this the first time that you had encountered the Dutch Reach? I mean, you're a pretty experienced cyclist.
I'm an experienced cyclist. I should say I've been car-free since 1990.
Congratulations.
And living here in Boston since 72, and biking a lot of that time also. And I'd never heard of it. And in fact, it was really a very disturbing thing to learn about the Dutch Reach, because it's the what-if question. I mean, had we been seeding this behavior, had we been teaching it to our kids, this accident might never have happened.
Now, you said getting the idea seeded in American society. That's precisely what the Dutch have done. I mean, you just handed me this flyer on what the Dutch Reach is, and it says, this has been Dutch common sense for 50 years. It's taught in school, and this is what's required to pass a driver's test?
Well, that's
what it's going to take here?
Well, that's part of the goal, I guess. You know, hopefully, it'll get baked into our society, as it has been with the Dutch.
I mean, it doesn't cost anything to do this. It just is a question of breaking a habit. How hard will that be, do you think?
Well, a lot of people take it on pretty easily. A phrase I like to use is, we're substituting one thoughtless habit for another thoughtless habit, except the second one is safer.
Bottom line here, this, as you put it, this thoughtless action could change someone's life, could save someone's life.
Yes. We need to change the culture. We need to accept that bikes are here. They're back, basically. They're beginning to want to have a share, a good share, a safe share of the road. And one of the ways, particularly in cities like this, to make it safer is by introducing the Dutch Reach.
Cambridge resident Michael Charney, who is trying to lead a campaign for the Dutch Reach all over this country. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That'd be Cambridge, Massachusetts, just across the river from us. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.